It's the Halloween edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a blast from our very first Halloween show, Can Ghosts Exist? The Real Witches and Halloween Economics. Let's begin episode 271.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. First, a quick note to my valued listeners. It seems that last show was a tad rusty. I will endeavor to see if there's any issues that require remedy for the show in general, but one thing I should explain is the distorted, tinny sound while I read out a quote from Ray Zeslan. You see, I've been playing around with altering my voice to distinguish my words for those who I am quoting on air. Normally I use a phase shift filter, and it kind of sounds like this.
I sound okay, and in my humble opinions, it conveys the ideas that these words are not from me.
Instead, though, I used a distortion filter, which made my voice sound like, well, you can listen to last week's show, no point in subjecting you to that again. My apologies. So on with the show. I should begin the show by explaining that I didn't think I'd be able to record this week because I had all the signs a cold was on its way. But alas, either my efforts to sterilize my throat, with the help of some southern comfort, lots of rest, and or, well, likely a misdiagnosis, I seem to have only suffered a mild setback. That said, I was sure I could provide a Halloween special on past segments we have done about Halloween. Much to my shock and horror, we only covered Halloween 3 times on our show, once in our first year, and twice about scientific institutions, NASA, and a museum, painfully using Halloween-themed press releases to gain more attention. That's all, and well, folks, that didn't seem right. So we'll start by revisiting episode 33, where we discuss the origins of Halloween, trick-or-treat safety, and of course, vampires and werewolves. Let's go back in time and listen.
Hello and welcome to our Halloween special of Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Hello, my name is Ethan, your grave-robbing historian.
This is Deadly Dawn, the Crypt Keeper and Pathological Assistant.
And this is Rob, a cognitive psychologist and zombified eater of brains.
That's good. I mean, being a psychologist and all. Eating brains probably comes natural.
Yeah,
aren't you worried about mad person disease?
Actually, the
I'd say mad cow disease, but you've lost a lot of weight.
Smartass.
Well, I'll gain it once again when we have Halloween candy.
Yes. Well, I'm sure that alert listeners will realize that today is not actually Halloween, but...
If you're listening to the podcast, it might be.
It very well might be. So, happy Halloween, everybody. Hope you're having a scary good time.
Yes.
Well, we're going to be talking a bit about some Halloween stories, some origins of Halloween, talk a bit about trick-or-treating, and then
a few myths and legends and their origins.
You know, actually, we're a skeptic show, right? So I don't really believe in Halloween. I don't think Halloween is real. Has anyone checked out to see whether Halloween is really a holiday, or is it just something concocted by Wall Street marketers intent to get my last candy dollar?
Well, interesting you asked there, Don. I looked up the origins of Halloween a little while ago, and what I found kind of confirms some already pre-existing beliefs, and that is Halloween, like any other holiday, is kind of a combination, mix-match of different festivals and holidays that come from different cultures and regions, and it's very difficult to kind of pin down when this holiday began or when it sort of took on its actual modern day form.
You hear a lot of different names being tossed around, things like, you know, All Saints Day, All Hallows Eve, Samhain.
Right. And sort of the big kind of assumed creators of Halloween include Samhain, which is a Gaelic festival, which is kind of centered around the fall harvest. It might have been their version of New Year's, and it's probably been their festival of celebrating the dead. All Saints Day is also kind of tossed in there. That's a Catholic holiday that celebrates all the saints, obviously. And it was sort
of... There's a lot of them.
There is. It was strategically placed in the fall season to kind of sync up with a lot of the other sort of pagan holidays that existed in Europe around the Middle Ages. And when I say pagan, I don't actually mean like there were a bunch of pagans celebrating it. They were definitely Christian. It was just a pagan holdover from centuries ago. The same sort of thing with the Gaelic festival. It was celebrating the Festival of the Dead, right?
Actually, from the research that I did, it goes along pretty much the same thing. But mine says that it was because it's closely tied with the fall equinox. And it's interesting how many Christian holidays overlap with pagan holidays. We were talking before the show that I think one of the things that you have to admire the Christian faith, and I'm sure the other faiths do a similar job, is the ability to come in to a local area, find out what's everyone celebrating, and saying, hey, you know, you think this is the Samhain or whatever festival, but really, this is the day of our saints. And you guys just don't know the word of Christ, but now that you do, you can start practicing the proper festival in this. So you keep all the...
Sort of the same thing that happened with Christmas.
And... Yeah, you keep all of the regalia, all the funness. You just change the placeholder, the name. So people get to keep their tradition, but they just change the name of the tradition. And it's a great way
it gets
to win
subsumed.
Over. Yeah, you know.
Well, it's true. Most holidays are basically amalgamations. And the Catholic Church, I mean, for example, has moved All Saints Day before. It's not always been November 1st. And I think kind of the fallacy, though, with trying to figure out what holidays, what the original origin is of any given holiday, is that you're kind of doing post hoc reasoning, which is a logical fallacy where you kind of say, you know, A became before B, so therefore B is related to A, which isn't necessarily the case. I mean, pretty much every culture on the planet has a festival of the death. And it usually happens in the fall, and that's not surprising. Fall is the season where plants die, the harvest is over, you know, just naturally goes along with people dying.
Not to mention many cultures, you know, placed around things around the equinox because they learned about astronomy and placed festivals there to celebrate, you know, marking the year.
So I think what Ethan's getting at is it doesn't matter why it came about. I mean, we have Halloween. And I think we can all agree that the Halloween we celebrate today
is pretty
probably
cool.
Is pretty different than what they did about 1,000 years ago or probably even 500 years ago.
Yeah. And I mean, you can look back and you can say, well, all in, you know, the Samhain festival, they had carved turnips or they, you know, put on funny costumes and danced around. Well, people have been dancing around in costumes for a very, very long time. Really doesn't necessarily mean that it's Halloween came from that.
And there's some, you know, contention over where carving pumpkins came in anyway. It wasn't maybe turnips. It might have been a jack-o'-lantern, you know, sort of that Irish myth of someone doomed to forever wander in limbo with a jack-lantern.
I always wondered if Cortez came by and saw jack-o'-lanterns on the Aztec step pyramids and said, oh, that's a good thing. We're going to start doing that. But, of course, they used real heads. But still, it's keeping within the spirit of the holiday.
I think we should use real heads. That'd be a lot more interesting.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious to know what your guys' opinion is on the idea that, you know, Halloween is like violent games. You know, do because all this violence, all this horror comes out once a year, does that make people more violent, more horrible?
There's a lot of, like, you know, you hear reports from churches and conservative people saying that Halloween is decaying the moral values of our society and how we're, you know, coming to worship Satan through fun with goblins and ghoulies at Halloween. And
which is kind of odd because I bet you, like, the number one selling costume this year is going to be, like, Michael Jackson or something.
Actually, the Onion did a piece about how to dress your kid to make sure that he remains masculine. Don't give him any of the quote-unquote airy-fairy costumes, but really manly things. Not a princess or anything, but... You know,
fairy wings.
Yeah, not fairy wings or anything, but make sure he's a cop or a barbarian or something really violent and masculine, you know, because we don't want to give kids the wrong impression that just because they get the cross-dress once a year that they're allowed to come out as a harlot. No, you got to be a man's man.
And meanwhile, all girls are supposed to dress in sexy clothes.
Ever notice that around Halloween that like 90% of the costumes they sell for women on Halloween are sexy cat, sexy witch, sexy nurse?
And... Yes, but we all know those were designed by pedophiles.
Oh, yes.
Right. Well, we're kind of talking about trick-or-treating here. I'd like to go into a bit about the myth about where trick-or-treating actually came from. And in my research, it's actually very recent, possibly even as recent as the 1950s. You get sort of isolated reports of something like trick-or-treating happening in the 1920s or even a bit earlier. But in that case, it's usually actually young people in costume kind of causing mischief and sort of...
Yeah, there have been mischief nights.
Not really trick-or-treating in the sense that we... picture, you know, cute kids running around in costumes. This is more sort of like gangs of adolescent kids with nothing better to do than their time than break windows.
Well, so basically the thing was, you know, these gangs of teenagers are roaming around egging houses and destroying shit. So the, you know, homeowners decided, oh man, we better give them candy so they'll go away.
It worked for the Vikings. You bribe them a little bit and they'd leave you alone. Well, until next year when they came by and you got to do it all over again.
Yeah. Well, the mainstream trick-or-treating really probably emerged in the 1950s and, you know, sadly to say, was probably created by, like, Disney or something. So I think that, again, you kind of go back to the old style research where people say, well, in ancient Rome, people dressed up this way, or, you know, in ancient Ireland, they dressed up and they went door-to-door. Well, again, people have been going door-to-door and begging for stuff for a long time.
This whole idea of singing for your supper, you know.
Exactly. So I think that trick-or-treating, very modern. I think that when we try to find the origin of any given holiday, we got to remember that when we look at our modern holidays, they are, in fact, modern within the last 50 years.
Now, there's no, you know, you look at other countries and they don't have a tradition of trick-or-treating, dressing up around Halloween.
It's very North American. Yeah.
So there's no guarantee that, you know, a holiday that seems so ubiquitous here in North America has origins that are in any way related to anything elsewhere on the planet.
Or that our conception of the holiday is in any way related to what might be in other parts of the world.
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, let's take a quick commercial break and we'll be back with more.
It's our pledge drive here on NPR, and we have a 20-minute field recording of a tumluku, which is a Bosnian instrument which can only be played when you have a pierced scrotum and three kids who have been killed by a landmine. It's unlistenable radio! You understand me?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Totally listenable radio.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker, our Halloween special. So, Rob, you're going to tell us a bit about some Halloween myths and possibly their origin story.
So, one of the most common Halloween myths is the dangers of going out trick-or-treating and not checking over your candy very carefully when you get back home later in the evening because of crazy people who put poison in their candy or razor blades in their apples or things like that. And this is an incredibly pervasive myth. It's been going around for years. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, we would, you know, we'd come back and check over all of our candy. We'd dump it out on the carpet.
We did that too. In fact, I was encouraged to throw away any non-packaged candy. So apples, oranges, cakes, whatever, into the garbage can they went. I was happy to do that.
I was okay with this.
Yeah. Apples are not treats.
There was one family that would give out peanuts.
Yeah, what the heck is with that? I mean, jeez.
Of course, that just shows that maybe this story, this, you know, planting of poisons and razors are actually a plot by Big Chocolate. Make sure you buy the prepackaged
candy bars. Either Big Chocolate or small children.
Yeah. So this myth, we just talked about how trick-or-treating is actually very recent. I would imagine this myth started pretty much right away.
Yeah, parents have always been worried about the safety of their kids. I mean, they're going around in the dark to strangers' houses. The parents, you know, with their watchful eyes back on the street as they watch their little ghost or goblin going up to some stranger's door and asking for free food.
And has anyone ever actually gotten, like, a syringe in their candy? Like, has this ever been demonstrated to happen?
Well, there was a guy, a sociologist named Joel Best, who did a review of newspaper articles, clippings, reports, anecdotal evidence, everything that he could find that was on the more likely side of evidence, going back as far back as the 50s, and basically found not a single actual case of candy poisoning or razor blading apples.
Really? Yeah. I find that hard to believe.
It is tricky to believe. I mean, he did find cases where kids would sort of, they would hear the myth and try it themselves, like X-lax brownies or you know, basic poisons and things. And I think there was one case that you found, or someone found, of a, was it a father who
actually put a razor blade in his own child's candy?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like, something like this is bound to happen by some crazy person once in a while, but I think the notion that it happens all the time is completely overblown. I mean, yeah, a sociopath who's going to do this would probably, you know, reveal themselves by, you know, attacking somebody on the street, right? So,
or trying to give kids toothbrushes at Halloween.
I think the real sad part of it is I mean, this idea, I think, has gotten progressively worse as times goes by. And part of it is mollified, perhaps, by prepackaged. But the idea, I mean, think of what you just said. We let our children go out on the street in the dark to strangers' house. Right? Now, if you said that in the 50s or 60s, you go, oh, yeah, no, that's no problem with that. Nowadays, you sit there and say, oh, my God, everyone has to be a pedophile, they have to be a murderer, they're going to kidnap my child. I mean, the whole idea that the restrictions that are becoming on Halloween, like UNICEF boxes. Kids don't have UNICEF boxes anymore because they're afraid someone's going to steal the money on them. And sure, there may have been one or two kids in the world that have had the money stolen, but it's not a pervasive threat. But it just seems how, you know, our society is becoming more and more fear averse, more, what's the, it's a, the,
it's the
mom.
Idea of a moral panic.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it raises a good point. Like, if it happened enough that you had to be realistically afraid of it, you'd be living next door to like 20 pedophiles. And I mean, maybe you live door to next to one, right? I mean, like, you got to keep a certain level of
realism
going on there.
Well, it's that whole cost benefit thing, right? I mean, okay, there are pedophiles out there. But if one
and,
in a
and
million...
And people who razor blade apples and people who want to, you know, do other horrible things.
If one in a million children become victims of it, right? And it's a horrible thing to become victims. But they probably become victims one way or another. If it's not Halloween, going to the bus, going to the pool, being outdoors in the backyard. But think of the benefit. I mean, this is a stretch for benefit. But kids like candy and they like dressing up, and it's a very social communal thing. But the
guy in the white van with no windows also is happy to give out free candy and help you dress
well,
up.
Well, yeah, we don't want to suggest that you shouldn't be prudent and you shouldn't look over your kids' candy.
You should use common sense.
Right.
If you're going around in a relatively safe neighborhood where you know a lot of the people there and, you know, you're keeping a pretty close eye on your kids, you probably don't have to worry about poison candy.
Yeah. And if someone, you know, snatches your kid while they're at your door, I mean, you probably can go over there and, you know, bang the door open and get them back, right?
And beat the crap out of them. Yeah. You did it.
And again, like, you know, you hear lots of stories about, you know, parents are forced to go to, like, malls or forced to go to, like, special parties. I don't think that the streets have gotten that much more dangerous over a span of, you know, 15 years since I went trick-or-treating, right?
That's a yes and a no. The streets themselves are actually far safer than they were 50 years ago. Now, some people will argue about the stats on that, but by and large, the streets are much safer now. But the perception of fear has dramatically increased, right? I mean,
you never know when there might be terrorists lurking in the bushes.
There was a study I was reading quite a while ago about the range that children used to play. And if you go back like 50 or 60 years, children would play within about 3 to 10 kilometers of their house. And then after about a decade, it came to like 3 or 4 blocks. And now it's like something like 10 or 20 feet from their door because you have this stranger danger type thing that's going out there.
Yeah. And actually, this is, if our listeners are a little surprised to hear this, you can actually look this up. And there's been a lot of sociological research done on this sort of thing, on how we perceive fear versus how, in actuality, how dangerous our neighborhoods really are. And the results are quite shocking that, indeed, things have gotten safer. But we are acting like they've gotten significantly
worse. Our perceptions of reality are totally out of proportion with reality.
Exactly.
I blame Fox News.
Speaking of our perceptions being out of proportion with reality, I thought we'd talk a little about the origins of common Halloween monsters.
Ooh.
Things like vampires and werewolves.
Oh, I know that one. Werewolves, you get bit during the full moon. And then you turn into your Uncle Phil, who has a lot of hair.
Or possibly Lon Chaney.
Yes.
Right. Vampires, you got to drink the blood of a vampire. Then you grow fangs and become averse to sunlight.
Or go to law school.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good one.
Are you saying that lawyers are blood-sucking monsters?
I would never say that for fear of being sued.
Well, it turns out that there are some reasons to believe in vampires and werewolves with certain qualifications. Some of the common characteristics associated with both vampires and werewolves are also the symptoms of common diseases.
Like what?
For example, rabies. Rabies makes you a little,
crazy.
More aggressive. As the disease progresses, it makes you go a little crazy. And also, people who suffer from rabies have a rejection of food with lots of sulfides in it. And what has sulfides in it? Garlic.
Well, there's also the similarity that people who get rabies usually get it from being bitten by a dog. And where do you get a werewolf from, right? So,
and then you also have the very famous, and I'm sure anyone does a little research, that there's a genetic mutation that has occurred. And there are people who are quite literally covered from head to foot in hair, and long, long hair. They're not werewolves, but they would pass as one if you ever ran one into one in the street.
They were quite popular in the 20s and 30s as sideshow freaks, actually. That was Timmy the dog-faced boy.
Yes. Mm.
But, what about vampires?
Well, I have a story here. A Spanish neurologist named Juan Gomez Alonso was watching a vampire movie, and he noticed that vampires behave an awful lot like people with rabies as well. So the virus basically alters the moods and behaviors of the affected. Some sufferers become agitated, demented, can turn violent. Rabies can also cause insomnia, which explains the nocturnal portion of the legend. People with rabies suffer from muscular spasms, which can lead them to spit up blood. What's stunning is the fact that these are triggered by bright lights, water, mirrors, and strong smells, such as the scent of garlic.
Wow. It sounds like the plot to 28 Days, though.
That was an okay movie.
It's a little interesting. And what makes it more interesting is that when you look at when vampire stories became popular as sort of the myths and legends of folklore of rural Transylvania, Germany, those areas around there, vampire stories became prominent in Europe at almost exactly the same time those areas were experiencing outbreaks of rabies.
Wow.
This was true in Hungary between 1721 and 1728, when an epidemic plagued dogs, wolves, and humans. And there you go.
You know, I could see that.
The birth of a legend.
I was going to say, some of them might be, he had the witch burnings and all that, right? And that type of thing. And you could do the same thing. But a vampire you could test any time. But a werewolf, because he's only supposed to turn during the new moon or full moon. That would be a much easier way to get rid of your rival across the street. Say, oh, yeah, in the new moon, he turns into a werewolf. Look at all the hair on his chest.
It's the same thing as, accusing someone of being a witch back in Salem,
Exactly.
Actually, there was also a Canadian scientist called Donald Dolphin who proposed a link between vampires and another disease called porphyria, which is a blood disorder characterized by irregular production of the iron in your blood, which makes you pale. Can cause seizures, trances, hallucinations that can last for quite a long time. Basically makes you go nuts. Now, the thing that's really interesting about porphyria is that people who suffer from porphyria also have this pale skin and extreme sensitivity to light. They actually suffer blisters and burns when their skin is exposed to the sun.
And let's, of course, not forget that there are some cultural factors that you might just be playing kind of crazy and thinking that drinking the blood of someone or something might instill you powers. In fact, there's this big thing, I'm not sure what it's called, where they make a practice of drinking someone's blood, well, metaphorically. Catholic Church, that's
right.
Oh,
yeah.
That's
right.
Well, on that, why don't we go to another commercial break and we'll be back with some more Halloween Radio Free Thinker.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power science world for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker.
Brains.
Yes, that's good, Rob. We're doing our Halloween episode, and I think Rob just mentioned we're going to be talking a bit about zombies now.
That's right. Just one more origin of a classic movie monster is the zombie. And there was a guy called Wade Davis from, I think, Toronto. He was an ethnobotanist, and he traveled into Haiti. And he was basically looking for the mixtures that local shamans used and looking at their applications to modern pharmacology. And he found a local legend of the zombie, people who would be given a mixture by a shaman, and this would cause them to die, and then they would be buried, and days later they would claw their way out of their grave and be in a trance and be able to be controlled by the shaman's every command. And he found that what was happening here was the shamans were administering this potion that contained tetrodotoxin, which is a poison made by the pufferfish. And what it does is it slows your breathing and turns off your nervous system, basically, shutting you down and making you totally slow and stopping your heart to such a slow level that it basically appears as if you are dead. And then these people are buried, the poison wears off, they claw their way out of their grave, and you have the zombie.
Do they really claw their way, or does the shaman go back later and shovel them out? And
There's some contention over that, but apparently graves in Haiti can be quite shallow.
Oh. Well, there was also a bit about they suffer oxygen deprivation, which kind of makes them go a bit crazy.
Yeah, which accounts for the sort of trance-like nature of zombies afterwards.
Hmm. So what would happen if there really was a zombie outbreak in Vancouver?
We'd all be fucked. No, actually, there are some mathematicians at the University of Ottawa, I believe, who did mathematical modeling of a zombie outbreak. It was some kids in a lab in the basement who were doing some disease outbreak models and wanted to see what would happen if people could come back to life in those models, and basically created this zombie outbreak model. And they tried a number of different strategies of how to deal with the zombies, like treatment or quarantine. And they found that the only one that really worked was extreme aggression towards the zombies as early and as often as possible.
And, of course, that would be a good metaphor, perhaps, for any disease, just not zombie disease. So perhaps the insanity, if some people call it that, about trying to beat down, I don't know, a local pandemic with hard, aggressive vaccinations and such might not be so out of place.
Well, that's not relevant to this conversation, though, Don. So.
we're talking about zombies.
Oh, right. We're talking about fake threats to humanity. Right.
Now, yes. Speaking of fake threats to humanity, or at least to, you know, single people in Ottawa, I think you have a story about...
Well, close, actually. This is a woman in Toronto. Apparently was arrested and accused. She's apparently a witch accused of pretending to be a lawyer. Now, of course...
not a lawyer.
As we all know, of course, the joke is that lawyers pretend to be vampires, and they do a good job, but this is a witch pretending to be a lawyer. Apparently, she bilked a firm in Toronto out of about $100,000. Once that became clear, the lawyer turned around and sued her, one, for being a fake lawyer, but also for pretending to be a witch. And I read that part, and I said... Pretending to be a witch, arrested in Canada? No, we are a forward, good-thinking society. But no, apparently Section 365 of the Canadian Criminal Code has that anyone who pretends to exercise or to use any kind of witchcraft, sorcery, enchantment, conjuring, undertakes for a fee, fortune-telling, or pretends to use his skills of the occult or crafts are... guilty of a crime. So the fact that she was pretending to be a witch made her guilty of a crime in Canada.
I'd better not mention that I'm a magician.
Does that mean that we could have, like, Sylvia Brown arrested?
Well, you see, there are two cruxes here. Because one, that there has to be kind of fraud, right? So if you really are a witch then I guess that's legal.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, how are they defining pretending to be one of these things? It's sort of slippery enough that most people will be able to weasel their way out of that.
Although I think, again, if we become more of an activist community about this kind of stuff, if we present all these fortune tellers with irrefutable proof, show them, see, this proves what you're saying is false, that from that moment onward, if they practice their quote-unquote craft
then they know that they have to be pretending.
Exactly. And they would be guilty of a crime in this country, or so I would think.
Well, maybe we should encourage our listeners to consider just that. And if they want to get some advice on how to do that, you can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com or check us out online at www.radiofreethinker.com.
We've been making light of Halloween and witches and monsters and things like that, but there are a couple stories this week that we have to talk about that involve real monsters.
We're out of time, unfortunately, so...
Oh, seriously?
We are. But let's just remember, there are people out there who die because they think they are witches in the world, and we're making fun of the idea of it, but we do know there is a serious side to it.
Returning to the present. We'll be right back after this break.
After decades of decline, drowning fatalities have been rising dramatically in Canada since 2004. Most drowning victims had no intention of going in the water, and harmless situations can become dangerous quickly. This summer, if you're going out on the water, even if you're not planning on going in it, be water smart and be prepared. Here are some things you can do to reduce your risk of drowning. Learn to swim and swim to survive. If you can tread water for a minute, you can orient yourself, and if you can swim 50 meters in a pool, you'll most likely be able to swim to safety in open water. Most drowning fatalities occur within just 15 meters of safety. Wear a life jacket or personal flotation device. 80% of all boating deaths were people who were not wearing one. Take a marine safety course, and if you're going kayaking or canoeing, know how to get out of your craft if it flips over. Practice basic safety moves such as wet exits and self-rescues. Save the alcohol for dry land after you're done playing on the water. And never go out alone. For more information and more safety tips, go to lifesaving.bc.ca.
And we're back. Did you know what else we haven't talked about on the show that's all Halloween-y? Ghosts. So let's get started. What is a ghost? Okay, we all know in cartoons, like, there's Casper the Ghost and the like. In the real world, it's a belief that the spirits of the dead people remain in our plane of existence and are capable of interacting with the living or other objects. Ghosts are likely the oldest spooks humanity has created. I am sure one of the first words spoken around campfires at the dawn of humanity was of spirits or ghosts of some warrior or the animals that they killed or gods performing some miraculous act. The more current manifestation of ghosts come in two main varieties. The spirits that mediums pretend to talk to while bilking the vulnerable and naive out of their money. Yes, you may have noticed I am a tad biased on this issue, but in the same way that I would sort of treat the Flat Earth Society. The other are the mischievous ghosts that haunt houses and do minor to major mayhem under the label of poltergeists, etc. Okay, there are a number of vids, posts, and shows that have debunked both types of ghosts, so I will lead off with the question, could a ghost exist? Well, what is a ghost again? Most believers say it is either the soul or some energy essence of the person or being. So let's assume that it is some energy or matter. Well, not so. There have been a number of experiments performed in the early 20th century to weigh a soul, none of which managed to, ultimately, proved that the body lost any mass post-mortem that couldn't be explained by some other mechanism. So that means that the only thing a spirit could be is some form of energy field. Okay, this provides us with a great opportunity to dispel a common misconception that energy is a thing. It's not. Any more than color is a thing. But wait, you say, colors are things. No, not if you think about it. If I say point to a color, you might point to a picture and say, there's a color. And I would respond in a subtle, condescending voice, as I'm apt to do, no, that's not color, that's red. To be specific, it's the electromagnetic energy wave somewhere between 6200 and 7400 nanometers. The point being, the term energy is a nice general term, but really means nothing specific. So if you claim that the spirits are energy, you must explain what kind of energy. Is it electromagnetic, gravitational, some kind of gamma ray? All of these have been tested over time, as they should be. Just because the idea seems out there does not mean we should not test it. But tests have been done. The jury is in. So far, it is of no kind of energy we know of. Okay, you might say. Maybe it's simply a type of energy we don't know about. Or maybe it's an immaterial object. That it is not actually part of this material plane. Something I've often heard from the spiritualist literature. Well, this leads to another problem then. If it's immaterial, by definition, it does not interact with matter. So how could it affect the things people claim? When a ghost slams a window, at some point it must interact with the matter of the window or produce some sort of kinetic energy. The latter would have been detected and has not, and the former is a logical contradiction. Something cannot be black and white, nor can it be immaterial and affect the material. So really, ghosts, although it's a really cool idea, and it's something that we have a psychological desire, you know, to believe that our loved ones live on past us, or we need some explanation for the bumps in the night, the whole concept of ghosts doesn't seem to mesh with reality in itself. Irrespective of what you might find on YouTube or those stupid specials you get on things like the Discovery Channel. Okay, let's move on to witches. We've actually covered this topic in the past in our interview with Liu Yigwe. That dealt with how U.S. fundamentalists have revived or infected parts of Africa with the idea of satanic witches, so as to provide a justification for exorcism and provide a foothold on the continent for their proselytization. But let's put aside for the moment, however scary Halloween might be, we humans managed to create even greater horrors. The idea of witches is almost as old as spirits. In fact, one of the primary jobs of the first witches was as shamans or priests. Yes, it may surprise some people, but many early religions did not make a distinction between witches and priests. Why? Well, in essence, a witch is someone who has two functions. Communicates with the other world, being that of the dead, the gods, or others. Their other job was to do magic, and often the two were interrelated. In a pre-enlightened world, there was a need, be it strictly psychological and emotional, to do something when bad things happened. If your child was sick, early humans were powerless. That powerlessness drove them to try, in desperation, anything. What society did was to designate individuals as special via whatever means, that they had a gift or knowledge or a calling that allowed them to do things that regular people were unable to do. A child would be taken to a medicine man. He would perform some ceremony that would placate the gods or the spirits, or drive out demons, whatever. Just that act in itself would help the parents, giving them hope, and it would also provide help via the placebo effect. No one is sure when this psychological defense arose, but it is something witches have used throughout the millennium. And please, don't let me denigrate these people as mere charlatans. The smoke and mirrors was a major part of their craft, but these were not stupid people. Through trial and error over generations, knowledge was gained in the application of both herbalism, what I would call pre-pharmacy, and basic medicine. As time moved on, part of the ritual was the application of the witch's brew, which may actually contain medical elements. Let us not forget that aspirin was originally taken as a tea from the willow tree, that First Nations people staved off scurvy by drinking birch bark tea. To us, this was simple chemistry. To them, it was a magic potion. That was the traditional witch. But of course, the witches we now think of, the Halloween witch, is a very different beast. And beast is a good term to use. Thanks to Christians and their desire to commit cultural genocide, they recast the helpful sages into satanic witches, someone who entered into combines with the devil and whose sole purpose is to torment people and destroy the community, a servant of Satan. That is why the current view of witches as gnarled old hags who turn people into newts arose. Nothing could be farther from the historical truth. Not that there was anything supernatural then or now. There is a new form of witch, the Wiccan, which is, at its best, spiritual feminism. One of the side effects of the Christian witch was to reinforce prejudice that women were somehow tainted and innately evil. The Wiccan movement is a feminist recasting of the concept of witches as magic. It harkens back to the time when witches were the wise healers of the community. And as far as their spirituality deals with love and communion, I have no issues. It's only when some venture into New Age healing of crystals and the like that I have some issues with. But Wiccans are not Halloween-y, so let's move on. I was going to talk about the undead, animated skeletons, lichens, wraith, ghouls, and more commonly zombies, but really, done to death. No pun intended. Okay, I'm going to shift gears a fair bit here. That, I think, has broadened out a little bit of what things bump in the night and we talk about. But of course, I have this overwhelming urge to take things and have an economic skeptical look at them. And well, with Halloween, show me the money. When I was a kid, you don't usually go to a store to buy a costume. You made your own from scratch. That was most of the fun. Every year, with imagination running wild, you tried to create a special costume better than last year's. The best ever. The one that people would be talking about for years. Well, weeks anyway. Could you outdo the costume your friend did last year? It was a time that everyone, rich or poor, had a chance to be a star of the show. No longer, my friends. There are special stores that open up for a week or two to sell prefab costumes. The same costumes hundreds of other people will be wearing. The exact same costume. How boring. In the day, you may have had 10 kids show up as a vampire or Darth Vader, or what have you. But each one was unique. Each had their own take on the character. It was like a competition, or it was entertainment. Yes, that one had the blood done really, really well. And that other one, did you look at the fangs? They seemed so real. Well, none of that anymore. Yes, there are still rebels out there who take pride in their creativity. And yes, in the day, there were people who, quote, dressed up as teenagers, i.e. they didn't dress up at all. And to be truthful, we all know someone who doesn't need a mask at all. But now, Halloween has become big business. Canadians spend $360 million on Halloween candy alone. South of the border, they spend $7.5 billion, that's billion with a B, on the Spook Fest. Now, that's scary. And when exactly did fireworks become such a big part of Halloween? Fireworks are for special events, like in the last century where you had like Canada Day, the summer fair, but not Halloween. You were too busy trying to vacuum up as much candy as you could before curfew. I suspect it's the Mexicans. Yes, it's all their fault. You see, they see Halloween very differently than we do. It's the Day of the Dead, and it's a festival of the dead, really. And they're big on using firecrackers to ward off evil spirits and the like. A thing shared with citizens of Asian origin. Now, the only fireworks that went off when I was out Halloween was a proper bag full of dog poo that someone would light up and leave on someone's doorstep. It was when the deed was discovered that I got to see Halloween fireworks in action. But now it's all about increasing economic importance of Halloween. No, not importance, but, well, profit motivator. Did you know that people will spend $2 billion to decorate their homes? Their homes! In the past, you would have a lot of people who would have carved pumpkins. A few people might put up a few homemade ghosts consisting of old sheets with holes cut in for eyes, flapping in the breeze. And of course, there's always one or two homes where the people with decorations and costumes tried to scare the hell out of the kids. Another fun part of Halloween, the experience of having this crap scared out of you. Now it's all prefab plastic. Blah. And people, let's keep it real. In the US, over $350 million is expected to be spent on costumes for your pets. Your pets. I apologize for using the emphasis voice, but it cannot be helped. So much of this is ridiculous. The US is spending almost as much on pest costumes as it spends to stop one of the worst plagues that has hit West Africa in decades. We could go to Mars on half the money they spent on those costumes. We could end childhood malnutrition. There's so much more we could do with it. But of course, If we didn't spend it on prefab costumes, Superman dogstumes, or designer chocolates, we would have spent it on iPod app or some other selfish bauble. Well, that's my take on Halloween this year. I think we're going to cut a little early this week. I think I'm going to have to sterilize my throat yet again. Where is that bottle I have? So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.
Would mathematics exist if people didn't? Since ancient times, mankind has hotly debated whether mathematics was discovered or invented. Did we create mathematical concepts to help us understand the universe around us? Or is math the native language of the universe itself, existing whether we find its truths or not? Are numbers, polygons, and equations truly real, or merely ethereal representations of some theoretical ideal? The independent reality of math has some ancient advocates. The Pythagoreans of 5th century Greece believed numbers were both living entities and universal principles. They called the number one the monad, the generator of all other numbers and source of all creation. Numbers were active agents in nature. Plato argued mathematical concepts were concrete and as real as the universe itself, regardless of our knowledge of them. Euclid, the father of geometry, believed nature itself was the physical manifestation of mathematical laws. Others argue that while numbers may or may not exist physically, mathematical statements definitely don't. Their truth values are based on rules that humans created. Mathematics is thus an invented logic exercise, with no existence outside mankind's conscious thought, a language of abstract relationships based on patterns discerned by brains, built to use those patterns to invent useful but artificial order from chaos. One proponent of this sort of idea was Leopold Kronecker, a professor of mathematics in 19th century Germany. His belief is summed up in his famous statement, "God created the natural numbers. All else is the work of man." During mathematician David Hilbert's lifetime, there was a push to establish mathematics as a logical construct. Hilbert attempted to axiomatize all of mathematics, as Euclid had done with geometry. He and others who attempted this saw mathematics as a deeply philosophical game, but a game nonetheless. Henri Poincaré, one of the fathers of non-Euclidean geometry, believed that the existence of non-Euclidean geometry, dealing with the non-flat surfaces of hyperbolic and elliptical curvatures, proved that Euclidean geometry, the long-standing geometry of flat surfaces, was not a universal truth, but rather one outcome of using one particular set of game rules. But in 1960, Nobel physics laureate Eugene Wigner coined the phrase the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, pushing strongly for the idea that mathematics is real and discovered by people. Wigner pointed out that many purely mathematical theories, developed in a vacuum, often with no view towards describing any physical phenomena, have proven decades or even centuries later to be the framework necessary to explain how the universe has been working all along. For instance, the number theory of British mathematician Godfrey Hardy, who had boasted that none of his work would ever be found useful in describing any phenomena in the real world, helped establish cryptography. Another piece of his purely theoretical work became known as the Hardy-Weinberg Law in genetics and won a Nobel Prize. And Fibonacci stumbled upon his famous sequence while looking at the growth of an idealized rabbit population. Mankind later found the sequence everywhere in nature, from sunflower seeds and flower petal arrangements to the structure of a pineapple, even the branching of bronchi in the lungs. Or there's the non-Euclidean work of Bernhard Riemann in the 1850s, which Einstein used in the model for general relativity a century later. Here's an even bigger jump. Mathematical knot theory, first developed around 1771 to describe the geometry of position, was used in the late 20th century to explain how DNA unravels itself during the replication process. It may even provide key explanations for string theory. Some of the most influential mathematicians and scientists of all of human history have chimed in on the issue as well, often in surprising ways. So, is mathematics an invention or a discovery? Artificial construct or universal truth? Human product or natural, possibly divine creation? These questions are so deep, the debate often becomes spiritual in nature. The answer might depend on the specific concept being looked at, but it can all feel like a distorted Zen koan. If there's a number of trees in a forest, but no one's there to count them, does that number exist?
My monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun.
In a shoebox.
The party had just begun.
In a shoebox.
The guests included Wolfman,
in
Dracula, and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash. Out from his coffin, Rack's voice did ring. Seemed he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said,
whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
The monster mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's caught on in a flash.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. Now everything's cool, Drax a part of the band, and my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them what it said.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And do my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
Mash cool. Monster mash ball.
Mash
cool. Monster mash
ball.
Thought he'd see people stand in line to see the boy king. How do you get so funky? Did you do the monkey?
Born in Arizona, moved to Babylonia.
Now if I'd known they'd line up just to see him, I'd take it all.
Walking Tut.
crocodile. He gave his life for tourism. Golden idols. He's an Egyptian. They're selling you. Made a stoner.
I will travel where no man has dared to go.
Into the black hole. Why, that's crazy.
If you fall in, you never come out. Stretching you from head to toe. Death by black hole.
There are monsters out in the cosmos that can swallow entire stars.
Inside these equations, there's a monster.
Anything that springs too close will be pulled in.
Gravity is infinite at the center of a black hole. Time stops. Space makes no sense.
Every galaxy has got one big black hole in the middle. And millions of smaller black holes.
An anomaly of gravity so strange. Nothing is more seductive. Nothing.
There are monsters out in the cosmos.
Locked and loaded, built full speed in the hot, hot hearse. Hot, hot hearse. Hot, hot.